anymore. It had been burned out from under them, and the land used for new farms by the goddamn Sfarestri, who didn't have enough evil points racked up yet, so they'd had to steal the little guy's home, too, and then kill anybody who didn't get the hint. Finn didn't have anywhere to go back to. But the law didn't care about that, like it didn't care about him. But I did, and I couldn't risk it. God damn it! I don't have him, but I'll get him, I told James roughly. If I have Finn out to help me.
Dory.
He has more contacts in that world than I'll ever have. He's how I found him this time, remember? And he won't help you, no matter what you threaten him with. He won't rat out a fellow troll. James was silent for a long moment.
48 hours. Then I'm bringing him in. And I'm not bluffing. Fuck.
Chapter 40. A short time later, I was facing the door to a sleek Manhattan apartment, feeling more than a little out of place. I had no makeup, my coiffure was a style I'd like to call drove with the top down, and I still had on the rumpled old sweats, now paired with muddy gardening sandals because I'd swapped with Claire so she wouldn't slip on the rocks. None of which should have mattered, since Horatiu is blind as a bat. But it wasn't Horatiu who answered the door, and promptly slammed it in my face. Or, to be more precise, tried to. But while Kit Marlowe is fast, so am I, and I got a muddy crock in the door before he could shut it entirely. Angry brown eyes glared at me through the minuscule opening.
Go away.
Fuck you. I gave a little push, and was gratified to note that Marlowe had to exert effort to keep me out. I also noticed that he was in a tux, which was unusual because he had almost as much fashion sense as me. But somebody, probably his long-suffering family, had wrangled him into a sleek black number anyway, trimmed the Elizabethan-era goatee he'd had since it was originally fashionable, and tried to do something with the dark brown ratty-looking curls. The latter had been slicked down with some sort of pomade, but they didn't behave any better than their master, and had sprung back up again. The result was wet, ratty-looking curls, which wasn't an improvement, but I couldn't talk at the moment, or do much of anything else, because he was really determined that I not get through that door. Which was ridiculous, since I had more reason to be here than he did. This is my father's apartment, I reminded him. It was Mircea's condo in the city, originally purchased, I suspected, for times when he couldn't deal with the consul anymore. Being a diplomat includes knowing when to get away so you don't strangle somebody to death, like Marlowe looked like he wanted to do to me.
He isn't here.
I'm not looking for him. I'm looking for Luis Cesar.
He isn't here either.
You haven't heard from him? I didn't get an answer that time, probably because Marlowe was busy. Stop slamming the damn door on my damned foot!
Then leave.
He glared at me furiously.
We're having a soiree, and you aren't attending like that.
A soiree?
A gathering, a party, a do.
I know what the word means, and I'm not attending. I just need... Marlowe kicked my croc like it was a football, and he was trying for a field goal from the 50-yard line. It sent my legs shooting out backward, and would have resulted in me face-planting painfully if I hadn't twisted at the last second. I landed on my shoulder instead, and it wasn't happy about it. Son of a bitch! I got up and glared at the now-closed door. I could have kicked it down, but my toe hurt. So I jabbed the bell a few more times, and then leaned on it when the door stayed stubbornly shut. Until it was flung open in my face.
Damn it, go away!
Damn it, answer the question! I guess Marlowe decided it was the quickest way to get rid of me, because for once he actually did.
Luis Cesar isn't here. I haven't heard from him, and I'm not going to. He's in a meeting.
What? That stopped me. What kind of meeting?
A Senate meeting. What else?
The eyes now looked impatient as well as angry.
An emergency one was called for tonight. Now will you...
Why wasn't I informed? I'm on the Senate. As usual, that reminder had Marlowe looking apoplectic.
But not that committee. The whole Senate doesn't meet for every issue, or we'd never do anything else. But that's where he is, so go plague the consul and leave me alone.
The door slammed again, probably because I wasn't opposing it anymore. I was just standing there in my smelly sweats, wondering why I'd just driven over here like a bat out of hell. Had I really thought Luis Cesar was going to beat up another senator over me? Risk his new position by taking on the consul's favorite shortly after being appointed? Throw away an opportunity that most would kill for, and over what? A damn Don Fear? Yeah. Judging by the pang in my gut, I guess I had. And that was stupid. We were broken up, and Claire was right. He hadn't even bothered to argue about it, had he? Just turned around and walked away. He hadn't made any declarations while on the phone with her, either. He just told her to mind her own business and essentially hung up. And he'd never even called me back. I rang the doorbell again, but not because of Luis Cesar. I needed to get my head back on straight, and that meant some kind of communication with my other half. And that meant talking to Horatiu. With Big Blue to find, God knew when I'd get another chance. And fuck Marlowe if he didn't like it. And I guess he didn't, because he didn't answer. And the doorknob shocked the shit out of me when I dared to grab it. I jerked my hand back and looked at the faint red mark the newly engaged ward had left. Okay, now I was pissed. Fortunately, Mircha's condo isn't in a sleek new building with slick glass fronts, but in a turn-of-the-century limestone beauty that he owns half of. A half filled with windows. Windows with curly-haired assholes in them.
What the hell are you doing?
Marlowe demanded, sticking his neck out as I edged along an ornate ledge.
I punched him in his stupid face. What does it look like? Get out!
I let him eat fist again, and he turned the ward on over the window, which blew me off the side of the building and into some bushes. It also blew my croc onto a nearby BMW, which was apparently a touchy little bitch, because the car alarm started screaming its head off. I looked at it for a moment while I got my breath back. Mircha hadn't skimped on the wards. Even on the lowest setting, they packed a wallop. And then I gazed up at Marlowe, who was still glaring down at me from the window, and I slowly took off my other shoe.
Don't you dare!
I skipped the croc down the row of cars like a stone on a pond, setting off multiple alarms and disturbing the genteel neighbors. Until I was snatched off the BMW and smacked against the side of the building, still grinning. I'd badly needed to let off some steam, and that had been fun. Not as much as making Marlowe eat concrete, though. I twisted in his grip, danced away, spun, and belted him. I put everything I had into it, all the pent-up emotion of a very bad day, and was gratified to see him actually go down. And then spring back up, almost before he hit the sidewalk, because the guy was flexible. As he proved when dodging half a dozen more blows in quick succession before grabbing my fist. It was the same maneuver Dorina had used on the Fae, and it hurt like a bitch. Until I used my other hand for a gut shot that had him letting go with an annoyed, "Jaw!" And then I ended up slammed against the building again. Face first, this time. I turned to the side to get my lips free.
I can do this all night. Or you could just leave. Or you could just let me in. I'm not letting you in. Then we have a problem, I said,
broke his hold, spun around, and kneed him in the groin. I took off again, hoping the happy burbling vamp from the phone would answer the door, but I got stopped with a flying tackle, which was less of a problem for me than for Marlowe, because I was in ancient sweats. Ancient, muddy sweats, because it had been raining at some point earlier in the day, and the section of tastefully planted greenery I plowed up was basically a mud pit. "You're gonna ruin that nice suit," I said through a dirt facial. And for some reason, that did what nothing else had, and stopped him. I flipped over to see Marlowe suddenly back on his feet, looking with concern at the patches of mud adhering to his formerly sleek James Bond getup, which was followed by him whipping out a pocket square and worriedly daubing at the mess. "Will water take it out, do you think?" he asked me, bizarrely. I slowly got back up, but he just kept trying to wipe himself clean. It wasn't working. If anything, it was just smearing the mess around, something that seemed to be causing him real distress, which made him rub it harder, which only made a bad matter worse. "Give me that," I finally said, and he actually did, passing over the by now sadly soiled pocket square and looking weird. Marlowe basically had two emotions where I was concerned, pissed off and seriously pissed off, which was why it was so strange to see him standing there in his muddy tux, biting his lip and staring at me hopefully. Because I was a woman, and we magically made these kinds of things okay, right? I sighed. "Come on."
"Where?"
"You're not getting that out. But Mircha has plenty more suits in his bedroom. One will probably fit you."
"There's a party in the main room. An important one. I can't just..."
I sighed again, impatiently this time. "You can climb, right?" We climbed. Thankfully, he hadn't bothered to ward every window in the place, and one of the ones in Mircha's bedroom slid open easily. I ducked inside, Marlowe on my heels, and padded barefoot over to the big wardrobe I'd been told to stay out of. I decided that, since I wasn't here for me, it didn't count, and threw open the double doors.
"Oh," Marlowe said,
'cause I guess he'd never gotten the tour. I'd been known to borrow Mircha's shirts as emergency dresses on occasion, so I knew what was in there. Basically, the pick of the great fashion houses of Europe, with a choice few American designers thrown in for good measure, and enough of it to stock a small men's store. Self-denial has never really been Daddy's thing. "Okay, strip," I told Marlowe, flicking through the couture, "and tell me what your problem is."
"You."
I glanced over my shoulder to see him looking around, as if wondering where to put his muddy coat. "Just leave it in the bathroom." I nodded at the adjoining room. "And that's not an answer." Marlowe went grumbling off, and I went back to trying to decide what might work as a substitute. It wasn't as easy as it looked, because sure, there were plenty to draw from, but Marlowe had the same issue I did, only not to the same degree. I could wear Mircha's shirts as dresses because he was 6 feet tall in his socks. Marlowe wasn't. "How bad are your trousers?" I asked, as Marlowe came out of the bathroom wearing nothing else, because I guess his shirt had gotten muddy too. I sized him up. The coats and shirts would probably fit okay. He was built well enough under the scowl, but the pants weren't just gonna draw up on their own. He was definitely too short. "You're too short," I told him, while he continued trying to clean them, this time with a washcloth.
"Well, what the hell am I supposed to do about that?"
"I don't know, but that's not gonna work." It really wasn't. The mud had splattered everywhere when we hit down, and some of the flakes had already dried into little cement nodules. A good dry cleaner might be able to salvage the outfit, but not in time for Marlowe to return to his guests. I went to the phone. Burbles picked up, and he was happy to help. No, he was thrilled. He'd never had a request in his entire long life that pleased him so much. Oh, my God. "Great." I put a hand over the phone and looked at Marlowe. "What size are you?"
"What?"
"Stop trying to clean those things. They aren't cleanable. Just tell me your size.
I don't know my size.
What do you mean you don't know your size? You don't buy pants?
Of course not. I have staff for that.
You have staff for buying pants?
Trousers.
He looked pained. Pants are underwear. Thought that was knickers.
Those are for women. And yes, my staff buys my clothes.
I sighed again. I do that a lot around Marlowe. Then take the damn pants, okay, trousers off, and tell me the size.
I can't.
Why?
I'm not wearing anything underneath.
I was about to respond to that the way it deserved when Burbles offered a compromise. Okay, I told him and looked back at Grumpy. How tall are you?
5'11". I rolled my eyes. Fine, 5'10".
Is pride worth tripping over your feet all night?
All right. I'm 5'8" and a half.
He's 5'8", I told Burbles.
And a half.
You're not 15 going on 16. Halves don't count.
They'll be too short.
Then give me the damned size.
Fine.
Marlowe stomped back to the bathroom, and I stood there in muddy sweats, getting cold from the air conditioning. Hang on, I told Burbles, and put the phone down on his effusions of joy. Mircha's wardrobe of the gods yielded a long dress shirt, which I thought might do. I stripped off the sweats and was looking around for something to wipe off with because I'd somehow gotten mud down my back. But even I draw the line at using Armani for a towel. Hey, Marlowe, can you throw me? I stopped because I'd just come back into the bedroom and noticed that we had a visitor, which would have been okay because I was still in a bra and panties and I wear less to the beach, and because most vamps don't care about such things anyway. You notice I said most.
Throw you what?
Grumpy came out of the bathroom with a towel around his waist and his trousers in his hand, which he didn't toss to me because he was currently getting tossed himself back through the bathroom door hard enough to crack tile. For some reason, I felt a stupid grin break out over my face. I didn't think you'd come, I said a little bashfully, to no one because the party had already moved to the next room. I walked over to the phone. Just take your best guess, I told Burbles, and hung up. I was still barefoot, and now there was shattered tile all over the rug, not to mention glass from a newly destroyed bathroom mirror. So I didn't get too close, just climbed onto the bed to peer through the doorway at what was amounting to the butt-kicking of the century. Marlowe was trying to talk his way out of it, I guess in preference to getting into a dust-up with another senator, only that wasn't working so well. And we kind of needed him alive for the war. So I threw the comforter over the shattered tile, jumped down, and grabbed Louis César the next time he had his back to the door.
Let me go.
Are you going to kill Kit?
Yes.
Well, see, that's a problem.
You crazy son of a bitch!
That was a bloody naked Marlowe, who was currently sprawled in the tub but still talking, which was great and all, but holding an enraged Louis César was not easy. Any second now. Yep, that's what I'd thought. He tore away from the door with me jumping onto his back to preserve my feet and proceeded to pummel Marlowe some more, who got his feet up in time to send Louis César staggering back into the sink, which was less than fun for me since I hit the broken mirror. The remaining glass cascaded everywhere, along with several good-sized pieces that I normally would have used as knives against my opponent, except my opponent was my boyfriend. Ex-boyfriend. No matter how hot he looked while beating up Marlowe. Cut it out, I told myself, and find some way to stop this. But taking somebody down the non-lethal way wasn't really my thing, and I guess it wasn't Marlowe's either, who opted for the better part of valor. He snatched down the shower curtain and flung it over us, buying himself a second to tear out of the bathroom. He went for the window, and he wasn't slow, But Luis Cesar caught him and threw him at the bedroom door, and then lunged after him and down a hall. Which is how we ended up crashing a very genteel party, filled with refined guests, trays of delicate hors d'oeuvres, discreet servants, and light musical accompaniment. And a bloody, naked master vampire running for his life and being chased by another, this one fully clothed, but being ridden by a bra and panties-wearing wild woman trying to slow him down. It wasn't working. But Marlowe was fast and didn't seem to have any compunction about trampling his appalled-looking guests. So the pale half-moons ahead of us made it to the hall before we did, partly because a couple servants took one for the team and jumped Luis Cesar, who flung them off with a curse and dove after the boss. "Would you listen?" I yelled, as Marlowe, the idiot, took a right at the foyer instead of heading for the front door and the parking lot. He might have outrun us in a car with the emphasis on might, but there was no chance now, so it was up to me. "This isn't what it looks like," I yelled, as Luis Cesar tore up a set of stairs I hadn't noticed before and burst through a door. "We were just trying to..." I cut off in favor of holding on and not taking any wooden shrapnel to the eye as he plowed through several more doors without bothering to open them first. And then we were out into something vaguely familiar. All right. Elia's ballroom. The guy who owned the apartment above Mircha's had been a senator, too, from the European court. I say had, because he'd recently shuffled off this mortal coil in favor of, well, from what I'd heard of him, something considerably warmer. I didn't know, since I'd never met the guy, the coil shuffling having happened before I arrived. And it looked like history was repeating itself, only not for Marlowe. Because my Uncle Radu was seated on a chair in the middle of the huge, now mostly empty ballroom, with a gun to his head and a stake at his heart. Chapter 41. Everything stopped, including Luis Cesar, who burst through the door and then just stood there, still as a statue, staring at the tableau. The only good thing was that it was Dumb and Dumber, a.k.a. Purple Hair and Blondie, who had apparently decided on another target but had been misinformed, because Radu wasn't on the Senate. He was, however, protected by a couple of people who were, one of whom had started to breathe heavily. "Oh, hello, Dory," Radu said, because Radu is special. I climbed down and glanced at Luis Cesar's face, and started talking fast. "How about we take a moment?"
"How about he dies?"
Blondie said carelessly, because he obviously had a death wish. He was also the only one with a lethal weapon. Purple Hair looked like a proper badass, in a shiny black jumpsuit straight out of the Catwoman catalog, but she'd opted for a gun. While not ideal, it wouldn't do lasting damage to a second-level master like Radu. Blondie, in khakis and a frat boy polo, hadn't been so nice. It was about to get him killed. "I have a room full of important guests downstairs," Kit said quickly. "We need their cooperation for the war, and this is not going to help." Everyone ignored him. It's kind of hard to look commanding while holding your junk. "Put the stake down and move away," I told Blondie. "That's Mircha's brother, Radu. He doesn't have a seat on the Senate."
"I know that,"
he sneered.
"We're here for you."
"You've tried that twice, and it hasn't worked out so well," I reminded him.
"Twice?"
Luis Cesar hissed. And yeah, the gorgeous Frenchman wasn't looking so refined right now. The blue eyes were tinged with silver, the color they turned whenever he pulled up power. And the fangs were out, a drop of his own blood glistening on that luscious lower lip. He looked feral. "They're just being stupid," I told him, staring at the blood, and fighting a strange urge to lick it, making a try for my Senate seat.
"I'm on the Senate."
Luis Cesar said, his eyes solid silver now.
Why don't you try me?
And okay, I might have been wrong about one of them, because Purple Hair flipped the gun around, walked over, and handed it to me.
Let him go, she told Dummer, who lived up to his name. What the hell? What is wrong with you?
He's going to kill you if you don't, she said matter-of-factly.
He can't do that. I haven't challenged him.
But he can challenge you. Now step away.
But Blondie was either really stupid or really entitled or both, because his chin got a stubborn tilt to it.
We have no quarrel with you, he told Luis Cesar. We just want a fair fight with that bitch of a...
And that's why you're careful what you wish for, I thought, as Luis Cesar disappeared. Not like he did with his master power, because he didn't need the veil with this joker, but moving so fast that it almost looked like it. The next time I blinked, he was by Blondie, who he grabbed and threw into Marlowe, because I guess he wasn't finished with him yet. And then a bunch of guys, Marlowe's men, at a guess, ran in and started chasing the fight around the ballroom. I considered interfering, but seriously, it was like 20-1. I thought they could handle it. Probably. I bent to help Radu instead, but found that he'd already freed himself.
You were loose all the time?
Purple Hair asked.
Your friend isn't very good at bondage, Radu said, tossing the cuffs on the floor and a shining curtain of dark hair over his shoulder.
Radu was Mircha's younger brother, but only by a few years. Something that ceases to matter when you're both on the wrong side of 500. But while Mircha looked 30, maybe 35 on a bad day, Radu could have passed for a teenager, if an elegant one. And tonight was no exception. Luis Cesar's sire was sporting a sapphire and gold-patterned robe and some plain, if buttery satin can be called that, lounge pants. It was an attractive set, leaving a deep V at the neck that showed off naturally bronzed skin and brought out the startling turquoise of his eyes.
It wasn't bondage, Purple Hair said slowly.
And why didn't you do something?
I didn't want to make you feel bad. Radu patted her gently on the arm. You were trying so hard.
How did you know I'd be here?
I asked her, as she stood there blinking at Radu, who tended to have that effect on people. For his part, he wasn't trying to rescue his son, who clearly didn't need it, but had instead started puttering around in some plastic storage containers stacked behind the chair.
Hello?
I tried again, snapping some fingers near her head.
Find me? How? Phone, she said, still looking at Radu, before shaking herself and refocusing on me. We tapped your phone and overheard you talking to Vincent.
Vincent? She looked pained.
The happy one.
Oh, Burbles.
So we knew you'd be here sometime tonight. We persuaded a few party guests to include us in their group and, well...
She shrugged. I frowned. With the mental gifts I'd seen her use, I could well believe that she could persuade some humans, even magical ones, that she was their best friend, at least long enough to get in the door. But there was something I didn't get.
How did you bug my phone?
You never had it.
There are ways to do it remotely. It's not my thing, but Trevor said...
Trevor? Despite everything, I felt myself start to grin. She bit her lip.
You're partnered with a guy named...
There aren't a lot of people willing to take you on.
For reasons, Radu murmured, still puttering.
What?
Nothing. He beamed at her.
Such a pretty girl. You wouldn't like being on the Senate, you know. So many boring meetings.
It's the pinnacle of our existence. It's what we live for, fight for, the chance to lead.
Yes, yes, that's what they tell you, he said,
examining something he'd pulled from one of the cases. "Until you get on it, then it's all fiscal reports and bad coffee." She blinked at him some more.
"Hey!" I called to Luis Cesar. "Don't kill Trevor. I need him to fix my phone."
"Trevor?"
He looked confused for a moment, and then down at his bloody lump of a club. He tossed it away, and it tried to crawl off before being trampled by the cavalry chasing their boss. I turned back around to see Purple Hair glowering at me.
"Don't blame me," I told her. "How did you think coming to Mirch's apartment was going to go?"
"We didn't have a choice."
"You couldn't just catch me out somewhere?"
"Like the theater?"
she asked sourly. I grinned. "Dry out yet?" She scowled.
"Sure. This is all funny to you."
"It actually wasn't that funny," I said, but she wasn't listening.
"Like running around in old sweats or..."
She gestured at my sensible underwear.
"Here are the rest of us, trying to be as intimidating as possible, and you go around like that. Like we're all just ridiculous and you don't have to care."
"I don't actually dress with you in mind."
"I know. That's what's so infuriating. Everyone else is so concerned with their image and you just..."
Her lips tightened.
"You walked out of that house the other day. No weapons, no makeup. Barefoot. And I wondered why my skin suddenly tightened. I realized later, the most intimidating look is not to have one at all."
"And yet you came back."
"What else is there? You don't know what it's like, starting with nothing and clawing your way up, year after year, century after century. Until finally you get within sight of everything you ever wanted, only to have that rug ripped out from under you."
"Sounds familiar."
"Bullshit! Daughter of a senator, dating another one, you're practically royalty."
"And a dirty domfier."
"Yeah, but even that, no one knows how to fight that. You're something of a legend, while the rest of us..."
She suddenly turned around and walked away. I turned back to see Radu looking at me disapprovingly.
"What?"
"You could have been nicer."
"Nicer? She's been trying to kill me all week."
Radu tutted. "She isn't powerful enough to kill you.
She brought a friend."
Radu glanced at Trevor and rolled his eyes. "She simply thinks she has to try, that's all. They brainwash them into believing that there's nothing else to do with eternity than rule over everybody else. Then they finally make it, and wonder why they hate it."
"Are you trying to tell me I won't like being on the Senate?"
"You're already on it."
"How are you finding it?"
"A pain in the ass."
"Ah,
the usual then."
"Is that how Geminis found it?"
Most people would have asked why I wanted to know, but not Radu. "Geminis thought he was Caesar reborn, and we were merely his court."
"Well, he was the oldest on the Senate, except for the consul."
"A 2,000-year-old fool is still a fool."
"And his family?"
"He trained them to believe that they were meant to rule over us lesser creatures. And yet, he never bothered with any sort of contingency plan for when he died. One had the impression that his plan was to live forever. When that failed..."
He shrugged.
"It left them scattered, leaderless, and at the mercy of us lesser creatures."
"I remembered Ray saying that at the bottom you allied with whoever would help you survive, no matter who it was. Who had they allied with, and where the hell did they fit in?"
"Usually I had to try to roust suspects out of the woodwork, but this puzzle was the opposite. Too many pieces, and none of them seemed to connect. There were smugglers and slavers and smugglers who were also slavers. There were trolls battling the bad guys and trolls who might be the bad guys. There was a Vargur who might or might not be a queen of the Light Fae, or possibly an operative sent by her husband to make it look like she was guilty. Or
possibly someone else altogether, because who the hell knew? After 4 days, I didn't know much more than I had when I started. I didn't even know what the hell they were smuggling. My thoughts were interrupted by the sound of Marlowe being thrown into the middle of a very nice baby grand.
"Oh, really?" Radu said in annoyance. "I was going to keep that."
"Seriously, he didn't do anything," I called to Louis César, who was now pounding out a sonata courtesy of Marlowe's head. "And we're broken up anyway. This is childish."
Louis César belted Marlowe and watched him go down.
"This isn't about us."
"Then what is it about?"
Marlowe staggered back to his feet, and Louis César hit him again.
"I don't like his face."
"Oh, that's mature."
Purple Hair wandered back over with a drink in her hand, while a dozen of Marlowe's guys jumped Louis César, I guess to give the boss a moment.
"You broke up?"
"Yeah."
We watched Louis César throw off the guards, grab Marlowe, and launch him at a marble column hard enough to crack it. He'd lost his nice blue suit coat, and his shirt was torn, showing off the kind of physique a vampire doesn't need, but which is still decorative. And his auburn hair had escaped its usual clip, falling around those broad shoulders like he was about to pose for a romance novel cover. Fabio wished he'd looked that good. Purple Hair must have thought so, too, because her "why?" was tinged with disbelief. "It's a long story."
"Then you wouldn't care if I'll rip your throat out."
Louis César, who had been pounding Marlowe into the parquet, looked up.
"What did you say?"
"Nothing."
And then Marlowe's guys reformed and charged all at once. I looked back at Radu.
"Why are you dressed like that? Are you staying here now?"
He nodded.
"It has everything I need. Several floors, a nice amount of space for entertaining, and a good number of servants' rooms. Of course it needs work."
He frowned around at the gold and white extravagance, the gleaming parquet floor, and the glittering chandeliers, all three of them.
"You bought it?"
"Yes.
I'm staying with Mircea while I get it sorted, but Kit was having a party."
"So you came up here?" He nodded. "And Horatiu?"
"We followed him," Purple Hair said. "He was serving hors d'oeuvres, but he got lost."
"That sounded about right."
"But then he started screaming his head off for no reason," she said.
Because it would never occur to her that someone like Horatiu could pick up on her intentions. But he had an echo of Mircea's gifts, like everyone in the clan, and while he might be weak as a kitten, he was brave as a lion. My fist clenched. If they had hurt him...
"He was going to raise the whole house," Purple Hair said.
"So you had to shut him up."
"Trevor said if he was going to scream bloody murder, we should oblige him."
I felt my fangs drop. She saw, and her lip curled.
"I don't make war on whatever he is. He's fine. He's tied up with that big blonde in the bedroom."
I assumed she was talking about Gunther the Gorgeous, Radu's bodyguard, a giant with the suntan and six-pack of a professional athlete, maybe a surfer, because the shag was a little long. But he was nobody's fool. And despite the fact that Radu hadn't hired him for that reason, he was actually good at his job. Bet he was pissed right about now. "I hope you did a better job on Gunther than on Radu," I told her.
"Didn't have to. He was already tied up when we got here."
I looked at Du. He shrugged.
"It was his turn."
I sighed.
"Why didn't you just call for help?"
Radu had Mircea's gifts to a far greater extent than Horatiu. He could have had half the clan here in a few minutes.
"I tried. She blocked me."
I looked at Purple Hair with new respect.
"Impressive."
Her lips twisted.
"Well, not so much now," and then we had to duck because a shirtless guy flew overhead spinning like a frisbee. I looked after him for a moment, confused, because he was one of Marlowe's boys, and they'd all been fully clothed when they came in. Then I spied Marlowe himself, throwing a settee at Louis César while wearing a new white dress shirt. Louis César and the sofa went sailing backward, and Marlowe snapped his fingers at another of his guys, who was trying to get out of a pair of trousers. He was getting dressed on the fly, I realized. "He's too tall," I yelled, and saw Marlowe's head jerk up. "The trousers," I pointed. "They're gonna be too." The sofa came whipping back across the room, taking out Marlowe and his guy. "Never mind."
"It will be good to get back to normal," Radu was saying when I turned back around. "I've spent so much time going to and fro, from the consuls to Louis César's. You have no idea. It's been so inconvenient."
"The consuls?" I felt my nose wrinkle. "Why would you want to go there?"
"It's where my laboratory is. Was before her men dismantled it."
And for the first time, I saw what looked like genuine anger.
"I went in the other day to find my equipment in boxes, all jumbled up."
"They just moved you out?"
"They carried in a bed while I stood there. Said it was for some ambassador or other."
He sniffed. "Is that what all this is?" I asked, nodding at the boxes. "Lab stuff?"
"Oh, no. That arrived yesterday."
Perfectly arched brows drew together.
"I wasn't going to let the Senate's brutes move a damned thing. Heaven only knows what shape I would have received it in."
He held out a familiar-looking orb.
"This is what I meant to be experimenting on."
I took it gingerly, because Radu was the Senate's mad scientist and had been known to work with some scary stuff. But not this time. I held the little orb in my hand and decided that the universe was fucking with me.
"What do you think?" he asked, watching me with bright eyes.
"I think you overpaid."
"They were free."
"I still think you overpaid."
"What is it?"
Purple Hair asked, peering over my shoulder, because most vamps don't need to buy the kind of insurance that I do. "Junk," I told her, and tossed her the orb. It looked exactly like the one James had found at the warehouse.
"Where did you get it?"
I asked Radu.
"From a smuggler's warehouse out in Queens. We'd planned a raid for earlier tonight, but somebody beat us to it. They managed to evade us, but one truck hit a light pole and was left behind. It was full of these."
He gestured at the containers.
"Huh.
Well, that couldn't have been Blue. He'd been busy tonight. So maybe the reporters had been right after all. There really was an underworld war going on.
But over these?
Why not just knock over another semi or hit up the manufacturers if you wanted them so badly? According to James, that's what everyone else had been doing."
"That's what the Senate wants to know," Radu said when I asked. "I was hoping you'd have an idea. You know about magic, Dory."
"Not this kind. But still, there was something going on with these weapons. Somebody was risking their lives for the magical equivalent of whoopee cushions, and I didn't know why."
Radu sighed. "No more do I, I'm afraid. But you know how the Senate is. Everything they don't understand is automatically my purview. Of course, it would be easier if, at the same time they're increasing my workload, they weren't also kicking me out of house and..."
His lips kept moving, but I couldn't hear any more, because an alarm had gone off, loud and insistent, drowning them out. And then the lights flickered off, and an electric frisson flooded over my skin, a wash of power so strong that it lifted my hair like a lightning bolt had just struck nearby.
The wards?
Purple Hair yelled, looking around, because the big boys had just come online, and they don't play well with modern power sources.
How odd.
Radu frowned.
Must be a malfunc—
The whole house shuddered, hard enough to almost knock me off my feet and to send Purple Hair to one knee. Hard enough to set the chandeliers swinging violently, throwing small scintillations of light everywhere, moonlight refracted through crystal. Hard enough to stop the fight in its tracks and to have Marlowe yelling,
"What the hell?"
from under Louise Cesar's arm. Too hard. Mircho was a senator. Senators have enemies. They also like to sleep in safety. And while he always had some human servants hanging around during the day just in case, good wards were simply what you did. The kind that didn't shudder from a single blow. Or blow inward in a carnage of expensive glass and fine-painted wood a second later, followed by a bunch of guys in masks. Looked like somebody wanted their stuff back, I thought, right before the world whited out. Chapter 42 Mircha, Venice, 1458. For a moment, everything was quiet. The ship creaked. The girl snored. The footsteps of the two men echoed vaguely from somewhere overhead, their master having disappeared back through the portal. But that was all. The hold full of unconscious vampires didn't breathe, didn't blink, didn't move. Except for the one with the broken arm, which finally finished twitching itself back together and then fell off to the side, pulling the rest of the vampire along with it. He hit the boards hard, and the sound reverberated in Mircha's brain. For a moment, he didn't know why, the panicked, "Hurry, hurry, hurry," in his veins clouding his thoughts. But then he realized. If he fell off his own stack, he'd end up sprawling either on the girl below or right beside her. He would almost certainly come into contact with her, might even touch her skin. And then? Maybe nothing. Touch helped his mental abilities, but even at his best, he couldn't control people with his mind. He couldn't make them do something they didn't want to do. But he could influence them, especially if what he was pushing for was something they wanted anyway. Of course, he didn't know that the girl wanted to help. She might just want to get away. In her position, he definitely would, since her life expectancy with what she knew was probably about the same as his. But he wouldn't know if he didn't ask, and he couldn't ask if he never got off this pile. He put his mind onto moving again, anything, anything at all, just so long as it helped his precarious position become a little more so. And when that didn't work, he shifted his attention to a finger on the hand that lay in front of his face, trying for a twitch that might send it sliding off the pile and possibly take him along. He didn't get it.
Cazzo!
And before he could try again, the two bully boys were back, along with a number of sailors. They started carting the vampires up the ladder, quickly but carelessly. Nobody seemed to worry if a head hit a beam or struck the ceiling as they were towed through the small opening. No one seemed to mind if half-healed bones were re-broken, or if a protruding rusty nail snagged an arm, tearing a great gash out of the flesh. No one seemed to care what kind of damage was done, and Mircha knew why. Abramelin had told him. Mircha had always wondered why there were so many mages in Venice. He'd understood why the vampires were there. It was a perfect feeding ground, with festival crowds regularly coming and going, most of them too drunk to notice if they lost a little blood. And before the new consul changed the rules, it had been the only place in Europe where masterless vampires could find refuge. But why so many mages? He'd originally put it down to Venice's size and wealth. A large, well-off populace meant plenty of targets for whatever scam the unscrupulous were running this time, and plenty of customers for the more legitimate practitioners. It was also a busy port, meaning that potion supplies were easy to come by. One potion supply in particular. Because while he'd been right about some of the reasons for the large mage presence, he'd overlooked the biggest draw of all. That wasn't surprising. It was almost unthinkable to him, even now. But unthinkable or not, the fact remained. The mages were in Venice because the vampires were. Specifically, the mages were there for vampire bones. No one knew exactly why, but vampire bones were one of the most potent potion supplies to be found anywhere. Not that they changed a potion, they didn't seem to have any effect on the intended outcome at all. Except for one. According to Abramelin, the addition of even a small amount of vampire bone to any potion instantly upped its power by several magnitudes. It could take a minor level ward and make it virtually impregnable. It could take a simple love spell and bind someone with utter devotion. It could take a spell meant to light a candle and cause a raging inferno. Put simply, it was a multiplier for magic, many times over. And as such, was worth considerably more than its weight in gold. The supply, however, was somewhat challenging to come by. Masters protected their families with deadly vigor, with even unimportant family members avenged lest anyone think the clan weak. Vampire bones, as magical as they might be, were a rare commodity. Or they had been before Venice was established as an open port. The Masterless had started flocking to its sandy shores, their few belongings on their backs, desperate hope in their hearts. Hope that was soon shattered by the reality of the place. For most of the creatures who found these shores, it had proven to be merely more of the same. Wealth, power, and position were the keys to success in Venice, and they had none of them. Stubborn types like Mircea pushed through anyway, struggling to scrape a living on the bottom of Venetian society, or to learn a skill that might endear them to one of its masters and possibly find them a home. But others, who had pinned their last hopes on the supposed refuge only to be disappointed again, well, suffice it to say that there was no shortage of vampire bones in Venice. They were as plentiful as seashells on the shore, literally washing up on the sand after the daily immolation. Every morning, the wretched and the damned went down to the sea to await the fearsome embrace of the sun. And every night, the mages and their assistants feasted, courtesy of the haul they'd made after scouring the beaches. Until the current consul came to power, that is. And the once plentiful bones were suddenly less so. There were still some poor souls, unable to cope with eternity in what they viewed as hell, who were willing to end it all. But for many, the change in regime had made a marked improvement in their situation. There were new safe zones in several areas, including the glittering capital at Paris. There were rights of way being marked out between them, allowing safish travel through jealously guarded territories. And most of all, there were laws against littering vampires around the landscape that you weren't planning to be responsible for. Masters were now expected to account for every child they made, and those who became too careless risked their own lives and positions. So the Masterless had less competition finding themselves a family, more places to search for one, and an elevated position even if they chose to remain on their own. For there were jobs where the unaffiliated were preferred, and they were becoming a rare breed. For the first time, the unwanted hordes of Venice had a real reason to hope. Of course, for the mages, the shoe was on the other foot. Not only was the supply of masterless vampires drying up, but the ones who did arrive weren't even killing themselves anymore. The once plentiful commodity, which had made the great mage families of Venice filthy rich, was suddenly rare once again. And then things became worse. Because somebody had started hunting vampires, taking by force what was no longer being given. And worse still, the bastards weren't sharing. Abramelin had been very clear on that point.
"There's nothing," he had told Mircha, his various beards quivering in indignation. "Not a scrap. The only shipments going out these days are remnants of old stock from some of the bigger traders, at triple the price. But nothing new, nothing at all."
"That's unfortunate," Mircha had said, trying for diplomacy while wondering if Abramelin was planning to augment his stock with him. But if the idea had occurred to the old mage, he gave no sign.
"Unfortunate? Unfortunate? It's like having your magic cut down to a tenth of what it was," he raged. "Everything has to come from us now, doesn't it? And we don't make nearly as much as we use."
"I can see how that would be troubling."
"Can ye now?"
Black eyes had glittered at him behind falls of grizzled hair.
"Then imagine this. Some of us aren't interested in workaday spells. We're innovators, visionaries, inventors. We are the future of the magical community, keeping it on a par with, well, you lot for one, and any other rivals we find out there."
"Yes,
But the old man hadn't been listening.
"Come up with a spell and somebody finds a way around it, so you have to come up with another. But it's trial and error, isn't it? 20, 50, 100 times I might have to attempt the same spell before it works, and then I have to refine it. And where does that power come from, I don't generate enough. No single mage does. So without our shipments, innovation has slowed to a crawl, and will soon get worse when the old stock is used up. We must have that trade re-established."
"I'm not going to help you kill anyone,"
Mircha had snapped, fear giving way to anger.
"I'm not going to help you collect anyone's bones."
"Have I asked ye to?"
Abramelin sneered.
"We aren't the ones butchering your kind, boy. But if it's found that some damned fool mages are trying to manipulate the price or whatever the hell they think they're doing, and murdering your people in pursuit of it, what do you think is going to happen then? To all of us?"
"Then do something about it. Find these murderers."
"Don't you think we've tried?"
The old mage threw his hands up.
"We've had people in Venice for months, good people, but found nothing."
"How is that possible? I thought you had ways."
"It's possible, young vampire, because whatever mages are involved, they've got themselves some help. Your kind of help. They must have. It's the only magic we can't trace. Your kind don't do magic. Ye are magic, and damned near invisible to our eyes."
"You're saying you can't detect them?"
"Not in a city full of you, no. And whatever magic, if any, is being used to support them, it's subtle. Too much for us to identify when half the mages in Christendom are also packed into that damned city, and working spells all the time. It's impossible."
"Then go to the Senate. They have resources."
"Oh, yes. Why don't we do that?"
Abramelin said sweetly. He'd been pacing back and forth, waving his arms and basically looking like a madman. But when he whirled around, the old eyes were shrewd.
"Perhaps I'll do it myself. Walk in and inform her scaliness that, oh, by the way, there's some rogue mages and a vampire or two committing mass murder in Venice and interfering in the trade of your people's bones. Can you help us get this sorted out so we can get things back to normal?"
"You're afraid she'll shut you down."
"I'm afraid she'll declare war. Mine and your kind are always teetering on the brink of it anyway, and this is the sort of spark that could set it off.
And even if it doesn't, she'll doubtless view this as an intolerable slight. And yes, shut us down. Which rather puts us right back where we started, doesn't it?
But if you explain, Mircea continued stubbornly,